This is number 0027, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and this is indeed the Stuff File program, number 0027. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File, we'll meet author Peter May. He's written the book called Virtually Dead, and he really goes all out to do research for his novels. How did this start?
Well, I started out my professional life as a journalist back in the 1970s. I guess that's where I got my enthusiasm for and my techniques for research. You never like to write a story, particularly when somebody might sue you if you get your facts wrong, without doing your research and making sure that you get your facts right. And I carried that on into the writing of my books. So it's very, very important to me that my readers know that when they read something that I've written, that everything they read in there, apart from the actual plot, of course, is absolutely true. I never write about a place that I haven't been to. I research all my facts very carefully. And I think that's important, that background of authenticity to my work that readers really appreciate.
Robert Siciliano is the author of The Safety Machine, and he really is concerned about identity theft.
Every day I'm seeing new breaches of data occur within the finance industry. I'm seeing small businesses where hundreds of thousands of dollars is being stolen from their online banking accounts. And then the bank turns around and sues the small business so they don't have to pay back the stolen funds. So this is an issue that keeps getting worse. It's not getting any better. And I believe it's because the finance industry as a whole doesn't want to spend the necessary funds to protect us.
We also have another segment with Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. And of course, we have an idiot of the day and lots and lots and lots of stuff. The guest Slater on this edition of the Stuff File program, the person who told you this was show number 0027, is Kelly Alexander from Virgin Radio 96 in Montreal. She hosts a Sunday morning show called The Jump with Kelly A, which goes on from 6 to 9 a.m. And Kelly is also the host and producer of her own online show called The Kelly Alexander Show. And that focuses on entertaining and educational content for women, everything from breast cancer to chatting with astronaut Julie Payette. New shows are available for The Kelly Alexander Show every Thursday by going to her website, which is www.kellyalexandershow.com. That's www.kellyalexandershow.com. And thank you very much, Kelly, for being the guest Slater on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff. We got tons of it. We start off with a story from the great state of Texas. You know, politicians are often accused of blowing a lot of hot air, but in Texas, the gubernatorial hopeful by the name of Farouk Shammy is taking that concept to a new level. Shammy is running for governor of the state as a Democrat, but he first made his fortune in the hair care industry and now says he's invented a blow dryer that grows hair. Yeah, that's what I said. A blow dryer that grows hair. Now, you run this blow dryer over your shiny knob of a head and watch the hair sprout. Shammy is the inventor of the wildly popular chai or chi hair straightener. I can't remember which one it's pronounced, but it's one or the other. And also claims his new blow dryer smooths out wrinkles on the face. He says he got the idea from his senior vice president of technology, a former NASA scientist. The secret is apparently infrared light used in the hair dryer, which supposedly activates the growth of small veins that grows hair. I'm not so sure I want something that is infrared and scientific, blowing hot air close to where my brain is located, but that's just me. Anyway, apparently the same principle that I just described with the small veins and the growing of hair is also the same principle that somehow reduces wrinkles on your face. Shammy says the product will be available shortly. Now, I don't know what's more outrageous, a guy who thinks he can grow hair with a blow dryer, or a Democrat named Farouk Shammy who thinks he's going to get elected governor in Texas. Good luck on both counts as far as those dreams are concerned. Okay, we were talking, as I mentioned a little later in the program, with Robert Siciliano talking about identity theft. We actually have an identity theft story here right now. This one from Denver. This guy named Robin Hood is actually accused of stealing, and not to give to the poor, but basically to give to himself. Authorities said a 34-year-old man named Robin Joshua Hood. Well, you know, if you name your kid Robin Hood, you're asking for trouble. Anyway. Where was I? Oh, yes. Authorities said a 34-year-old named Robin Joshua Hood found someone's wallet in downtown Denver and apparently began using the man's name in a ploy to avoid being caught on a warrant. Hood told investigators he was being investigated for drug charges. Hood was charged with identity theft and impersonation. Authorities said Hood's true identity was uncovered after an employee at a record store stopped him as he allegedly was leaving without paying for three baseball caps back on January 6th. He was issued a court summons in that case. Okay, here's a story for all you Catholics out there. British church leaders are encouraging people to give up their iPods for Lent instead of the more traditional vices such as chocolate to help save the planet. The Bishop of London, Richard Charteris, and the Bishop of Liverpool, James Jones, are among those calling for a carbon fast for Lent, a period ahead of Easter, which Christians traditionally consider a time for penance and reflection. As well as spending a day without using technology such as mobile phones or iPods, the 46 daily suggestions also include eating by candlelight, cutting meat and vegetables thinner so they cook faster, and flushing toilets less often. Instead of giving up chocolate for Lent, why not fast for justice to help those suffering with the effects of climate change, said Jones. Well, good luck with that one, Padre. Somehow I don't think people are going to give up their iPods, but have faith. That's what I say. Have faith. On to Florida. A woman was charged with driving under the influence after showing up at the Flagler County Jail and demanding a conjugal visit with a specific inmate. The sheriff's office reports that a 45-year-old woman had a visitation appointment that was turned down because she was late. Also, the jail does not allow conjugal visits. The woman drove away but reportedly returned a short time later. Jail guards called road patrol because they suspected the woman had been drinking. Deputies found the woman sitting in her car. She reportedly failed a field sobriety test and a breath test showing that she had a blood alcohol content that was 0.256%. Florida law considers a person impaired at 0.08. The woman was charged with DUI and later released on $500 bail. Boy, drunk and heading to the big house for a conjugal visit. Yeah, somewhere in there is a lucky guy. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File, on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the latest updated version of the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders has just been released. Everybody, yay! It's kind of known as the psychiatrist's Bible, and according to the new edition, nothing whatsoever in life is ever your fault. It doesn't seem to matter what your problem is, there is a mental disorder that covers it. Did you lose the remote control and can't be bothered to get up to change the channel on the TV? Not your fault. You're not lazy, you simply have sluggish cognitive tempo disorder. Or maybe you're prone to a bit of a temper tantrum when you misplace your car keys. Well, clearly you're suffering from intermittent explosive disorder. These are just a couple of the dozens of extravagantly titled conditions, most of which have traits that can be more easily explained as general laziness. And there are big concerns that the revised manual will trigger a boom for drug companies. Richard Bentall, professor of clinical psychology at Bangor University, dismissed the new conditions as having, quote, no basis in science, unquote, adding, the more disorders there are, the more private business psychiatrists get. But the American Psychological Association, which compiles the manual, says the new disorders simply reflect changes in our society. I don't know if I like where the society is going, but maybe I have a disorder. Okay, on to our first guest here on the Stuff File program. You know, Scottish thriller writer Peter May is renowned for taking his research seriously. Before writing his China thriller series of books, he managed to get behind the scene of the Beijing and Shanghai police. For his Enzo File series, set in France, he took a professional course in wine tasting and was inducted as a Chevalier of French Wines. For his latest book, the standalone thriller Virtually Dead, he set up a private detective agency and spent over a year mastering surveillance techniques, learning how to tail and eavesdrop. And his international agency had no borders or boundaries, and he was hired by clients from all over the world. Peter May is on with us right now through the magic of technology that is Skype-to-Skype communications. He's in France. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hi, Peter. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So you really get into your research.
I do. I think the one thing that you omitted to tell your listeners there is that although I did set up this detective agency, it was what you might describe as a virtual detective agency, which operated in the virtual world Second Life, which was the setting for the new book, Virtually Dead.
Well, I was going to get there, but the fact that you did this and spent this much time studying that, and you've done a lot of research in your previous books as well, are you somebody who just likes to, or I guess I can describe as a chameleon?
Well, I started out my professional life as a journalist back in the 1970s, and I guess that's where I got my enthusiasm for and my techniques for research. You never like to write a story, particularly when somebody might sue you if you get your facts wrong, without doing your research and making sure that you get your facts right. And I carried that on into the writing of my books. So it's very, very important to me that my readers know that when they read something that I've written, that everything they read in there, apart from the actual plot, of course, is absolutely true. I never write about a place that I haven't been to. I research all my facts very carefully. And I think that's important, that background of authenticity to my work that readers really appreciate. Yeah.
So tell us about the story behind Virtually Dead, which, as you say, takes place not necessarily in reality, but in the online world.
Yeah, this was a diversion for me because I mean I'd finished my China series, and I was in the middle of writing, and still am writing, my Enzo File series, and. You know, I was a scriptwriter in television for 20 years, writing serial drama. So, you know, I was in this kind of serial mode in my head, and I thought it's time I did something that was different, a standalone. And I was watching a television show, which was all about this virtual world called Second Life, which you access through the internet, and it intrigued me, and I did some research and I did some reading about it, and I discovered that in fact, it is literally a parallel world that exists in another dimension, the virtual dimension, and people go in there and they lead alternative lives. They can live out their fantasies. They can be whatever they want to be. People who are in a wheelchair, for example, are suddenly mobile again. It gives you an opportunity to dream and live your dreams for real. But the flip side of that is that some people have abused it. It has been used for money laundering. It has been used, or it's claimed to have been used by terrorists as a meeting place where basically nobody can eavesdrop on them. And it can be accessed from anywhere in the world. And it's something that you have to experience for yourself. And I decided that I you know, being a crime writer, it looked like it had possibilities. So I signed up for it and I created my own avatar, who's called Flick Folds. And Flick Folds set up his own detective agency. And through working on the detective agency, I learned really all about Second Life and the people who exist in that netherworld.
Have you had the opportunity, now the book is out, to be in contact with any of the people who you've dealt with in the virtual world who now realize that you were doing research for a book? Or have the two personalities never met?
When I first went in, I was very open about what I was doing, the fact that I was there, that I was, to research a book. But as time went on and I was working in the agency, I didn't reveal this to the clients, for example, only to the friends that I made within Second Life. So I guess that there are a few clients out there now who realized that I was just researching a book. However, that didn't affect the way that I did my job as a private eye. I did the very best that I could for the clients who came to me, and I think I did not a bad job. The actual story of the book, it involves a character called Michael Kapinski, who in real life lives in Newport Beach in Southern California. He's a crime scene photographer. And 6 months ago, he lost his wife, and he's having serious problems dealing with the grief. And his therapist recommends that he joins in group therapy sessions that she's holding in this virtual world, Second Life. And so he signs up and goes in there meets somebody who invites him to join their detective agency. And he discovers that crime scenes that he's been to in real life are being replicated in Second Life, and that the avatars who belong to the real life people who've been murdered are also being disposed of in Second Life, and that there is a connection between the two things. So he begins an investigation, but it's also an exploration of his other self, which is something that Second Life allows you to do. Part of the theme of the book was how the experience of being somebody else, Chaz Chesnikov is his alter ego in the virtual world, how the things that Chaz learned and the relationships that he made in Second Life actually changed Michael in real life. And there's this strange dichotomy that exists between the two worlds, there is this extraordinary ability to move backwards and forwards between one and the other, with each one informing the other. And so at the end of the book, real life Michael has changed considerably.
How has your experience in the virtual world affected or changed you?
I have learned a lot about myself. I think that one of the things that you learn very early is that it's a very addictive thing. And I met many people in Second Life who really it became not their second life, but their first life. I mean, a lot of people spending 15, 20 hours a day in there. All their friends are in there, all their social interaction, and really all their waking hours. And it's quite an extraordinary thing. And the other thing that I discovered mainly through the agency is that, you know, people have very intense relationships in there. And I would say 90% of the cases that I got as a private detective were infidelity cases, strange though that may seem. People have relationships. They're very intense because it's a very intense world. The day only lasts for 2 hours. You don't waste time in the day eating or traveling. You teleport from one place to another. So it's a very, very condensed and intense experience, and relationships are very intense as well. And all those other emotions that go with relationships, jealousy, hatred, love, they are also very intense. I think it's changed me in the sense that I got a chance to look at myself in a different light. I made relationships and friends in there that I'd probably never have made in real life. And I've learned from them, and I've taken that learning process with me back into real life.
Have you, as I said in the introduction, you spent a year mastering all this to write the book. Generally speaking, do you spend that time normally researching a book? And how much time do you spend initially researching before you actually start writing?
I spend a lot of time researching. From the germ of an idea, I spend probably 4 to 5 months researching and developing that idea. And then I will write a very detailed synopsis of my storyline, probably about 18 or 20,000 words long. And when I've written that storyline, I know what further research I need to do and what locations I need to visit. So I then go and visit all the locations I'm going to write about. So, I mean, that, you know, when I was writing the China series, that took me to China. I mean, I spent many, many months in China researching the books. The current series, the Enzo Files, I travel all over France, which is a wonderful experience for me. I mean, it's part of the joy of writing for me is that I can actually travel and meet people and see places and experience things that I wouldn't normally see and do and experience. In China, for example, you know, I mean, seeing bodies pulled out of the drawers in the morgue in Shanghai, or visiting the police headquarters, the forensics department in Beijing, sitting in a courtroom in China. Extraordinary experiences. For my latest book, the one I've just finished writing, which is set in the world of haute cuisine in France, I spent 3 days in the kitchen of the best-known chef in France, Michel Brasse, who's a 3-star Michelin chef. And that was an amazing experience, I can tell you. I also ate very well. You know, I'm prepared to make sacrifices for my research. After I've done my research, so that whole process takes maybe 4 or 5 months, 6 at the most. I then write very, very fast. I'm up at 6 every morning. I write 3,000 words a day. I'm generally finished the book in 6 weeks.
Wow. The latest book is entitled Virtually Dead. It's written by Peter May, and it's available right now. And you can also find it via Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I thank you very, very much, Peter, for taking the time all the way from France to be on the program with us.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you, Peter. Thank you very much.
Peter May, author of Virtually Dead. You can find more information at Peter's website, which is www.petermay.co.uk. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is 0027, and you can find links to Peter's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet Robert Siciliano, the author of The Safety Minute, as we talk about identity theft. And Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Plus, of course, we have an idiot of the day. But right now, more stuff coming at you. What are the odds of this? You're a mother home alone whose 6-year-old son is choking and has stopped breathing. You furiously dial 911, and the dispatcher calmly talks you through the necessary procedures to save your kid's life. And, oh yeah, the dispatcher who answered just happens to be your son's father and your husband. That's exactly what happened in Olympia, Washington. Chris Scott calmly talked his wife through a procedure that cleared the boy's airway. His wife, Jana, said while they recognized each other's voices, there was not time for pleasantries, and she firmly believes her husband's demeanor saved her son's life. His supervisor, Tammy Clark, was impressed by Scott's calm manner during the call. When she told him, "You saved that boy's life," Scott responded by saying, "That was my son." By the way, Scott is a Marine reservist who recently returned from Iraq. You demand, Scott. You demand. That's an amazing feel-good story. Okay, from that feel-good story to the other end of the spectrum, we've heard of dysfunctional families, but this is ridiculous. In Tampa, Florida, a 52-year-old man has been arrested for trying to set his 77-year-old father on fire with a homemade blowtorch. The Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office says the suspect doused his father with gasoline, then made a blowtorch with a can of bug spray and a lighter. He allegedly sprayed it on his father but missed. The son was arrested the next morning and charged with aggravated assault on someone older than 65 and battery on someone older than 65. Apparently, the two had been arguing over money. In Florida, by the way, doing bad things to people over 65 carries a much stiffer penalty. Under 65, apparently they don't seem to care as much. Wow. Fathers and sons. Paging Marvin Gaye. Paging Marvin Gaye. Okay, speaking of kids, let's go to Germany, shall we? Kids in Berlin are free to make as much noise as they like after changes to the city's noise pollution laws, which now apparently tolerate their racket. After complaints by residents living near play areas and leisure centers, Berlin has changed its legislation to state that the disturbing noises made by children is fundamentally and socially tolerable. Until now, only church bells, emergency service sirens, snowplows, and tractors were exempt from laws governing noise. The Organization for the Protection of Children welcomed the move, saying, "We live in a city, and children should be allowed to play and make noise." Isn't that nice? Lovely. Okay, we have another story dealing with kids and family. Well, actually not so much kids, but family. Well, here goes. A father and daughter in England have spent nearly 50 years apart, but they have finally been reunited thanks to, wait for it, Facebook. 51-year-old Frances Simpson had spent the last 33 years searching for her dad, 72-year-old Tony McNaughton. Then a friend researched her family tree, and Frances found out she had a half-sister named Kim McNaughton, who she found on Facebook. Frances then sent her a message saying, "This will be a bit of a shock, but I think I'm your sister." 19-year-old Kim was stunned and replied, "Do you want to talk to my dad? He's sitting right next to me." Dad and daughter began chatting on the website and had an emotional reunion that weekend after 48 years apart. Tony said, "Even though we lost touch, I've never, ever forgotten Frances." Isn't that lovely? Well, I'm still waiting for the other shoe to drop on these lovely, touching stories of long-lost relatives and friends. There is bound to be someone out there who really doesn't want to be found. Stay tuned for that one. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File, here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, still with computers to a certain degree, and hackers in this case, Russian police said they have arrested a prankster who hacked into a computer system to show a pornographic movie on a giant advertising screen, causing havoc on a busy Moscow thoroughfare. The 2-minute clip, displayed on a video screen above a main road south of the Kremlin, caused midnight traffic jams and a frenzy of excitement across the Russian blogosphere. Police said the hacker gained control of the screen by breaking into an online company's server in the volatile southern region of Chechnya as, quote, "he didn't think the police would go looking for him there," unquote. The hacker is a highly educated, temporarily unemployed, and extremely advanced internet user, police said. The scandalous film was the talk of the town. The 40-year-old man said he wanted to, quote, "give people a laugh." Ha, 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 ha. You know, actually, an elderly motorist suffered a heart attack at the wheel after seeing the scenes. Wow. A pornographic movie that could give some guy a heart attack? You think there was somebody in the film perhaps he recognized? I don't know. Anyway, on to our next guest. Most people have heard the horror stories about credit card and identity theft and do whatever they can to protect themselves from becoming a victim. However, according to security consultant to Intellius.com, Robert Siciliano, criminals are becoming savvier when it comes to collecting people's personal information, and the government and banks are doing very little to protect the public. Robert is on the line with us right now. Hi, Robert. How are you?
I am great, thank you.
So why aren't the banks doing and the government doing a lot to protect people in this regard?
Well, you know, they are doing something. They're just not doing enough. Banks, retailers, the financial industry is certainly on the front lines of this issue, but I find that they know the least about the problem than most other industries. Every day I'm seeing new breaches of data occur within the finance industry. I'm seeing small businesses where hundreds of thousands of dollars is being stolen from their online banking accounts. And then the bank turns around and sues the small business so they don't have to pay back the stolen funds. So this is an issue that keeps getting worse. It's not getting any better. And I believe it's because the finance industry as a whole doesn't want to spend the necessary funds to protect us.
We should mention also that you, Robert, are the author of the book, The Safety Minute, How to Take Control of Your Personal Security and Prevent Fraud. One of the other things that I wanted to touch on is the fact that in this day and age, so many of us are using social networking forums, be it Facebook and Twitter and the like. Is there a concern? Are criminals hacking into social networking pages to get personal information?
Social media is a great opportunity for criminal hackers to get our data. And the way they do it is they don't necessarily hack the social network itself. While that certainly has happened, usernames, passwords, data has been hacked into and stolen from social networks. The path of least resistance generally is the user themselves, meaning that you might get an email, let's say, that your friend from Facebook has a funny video they want you to see, and you get this email that has your friend's picture in it and even their name, and there's a link to watch this video, and then you click on that link to watch it, and it tells you you have to download this program to watch the video. So there's a special video player, and then you download that, you install it. Next thing you know, your PC has a virus on it that allows a criminal hacker to remotely access and control your computer and also get access to your usernames and passwords for your Facebook or other social media site. Now they have full access to your page. Once they access your page, they literally are on your social networking site posing as you, communicating with your friends as you, and now they begin to con your friends and family, saying that, let's say you are in the UK, your wallet was stolen, and the only way you're going to get home is if they wire you money via Western Union. And believe it or not, if you have, you know, 20, 30, or even 300 or 400 friends, somebody will respond to that criminal hacker and actually wire them money overseas.
Wow. From what you're describing, it sounds like the best case is just simple vigilance.
You know, if you get an email like that, you should hit delete. You know, any type of communication you get from anyone that looks remotely suspicious, or they're asking you to update information, they're asking you to click on any links in the body of an email, I never, ever click links in the body of an email. You have to be smart about this stuff, though. You have to be aware. You have to be alert. We are in the worst cybercrime climate thus far. The Internet, as we know it, the World Wide Web, consumer access to this type of information, is less than 20 years old, and we are, you know, no smarter today than we were 20 years ago as to how to use it or how to secure it. People are getting picked off every single year. The 419 Nigerian scams, you know, the one when you receive an email from General Mutumbi Babatu Wabambu, right?
Right.
Asking you to help him transfer money from one account to the other. Those scams doubled in losses in 2009. We're not getting any better at this stuff.
Well,
scammers are getting better.
It's funny you should bring that up, because I was just talking to somebody the other day and I got one of those emails and I was saying, is anybody still falling for this?
Yeah, it doubled. And one of the reasons why it doubled is because many, many more people are getting access to the Internet, not just in the United States, but all over the world. So this fresh meat globally for these criminal hackers to tap into, people who are just getting a connection to the Internet in a lot of the developing countries, getting rused by the same scams that we were 3, 4, and 5 years ago. So now you have criminal hackers from all over the world that are focusing on not just Americans, but, you know, people in their own backyard. And the information that's out there about us, it's readily available in databases and filing cabinets, online and publicly available websites. And they're taking all this information, putting it together, and they're committing two types of fraud. One is new account fraud. New account fraud is when they open up new accounts under your name. They get a new credit card, a new loan, and so forth. And when they open up these new accounts under your name, then they don't pay the bill. You know, they turn that information into cash as quickly as possible. They get a credit card under your name. They max that thing out. They don't pay the bill. 6, 8 months later, you start getting calls from bill collectors saying, hey, why didn't you pay this credit card off? Now you find out that, you know, you can't get a loan for a home or a car. For that matter, you can't get a job because now an employer looks at your credit report to see if you're responsible. If they see that you haven't paid bills in quite some time, they don't know you're a victim of identity theft, and neither do you, for that matter. You're not going to get the job. So new account fraud, the nightmare. And then account takeover is when they will access existing accounts that you have, access your online banking or your credit card accounts, make fraudulent charges without your authorization. And when this occurs, you don't find out that until you check your statements. And if you're not checking your statements, you may not find out to the end of the year until you do your taxes. So you have to pay really close attention to your existing accounts, and you have to protect yourself from new account fraud.
Now, I understand that another thing that scam artists are doing is webcams can actually be hacked in to spy on people. Is that correct?
You know, if your PC is compromised, then every aspect of your PC could be compromised. And that includes your peripherals, and one of your peripherals being a webcam. And webcams can be remotely controlled to spy on you. They sense audio, they sense video, and they literally can be used to watch what you do in your own home. Your computer is a tool that does an awful lot today, more so than it did a decade ago. And the criminal hacker, the bad guy that understands how it works, can remotely control that machine if you don't know how to secure it. You have to do all the different things like updating your operating system. If you're in a Windows environment, making sure that your PC's critical security patches are updated, making sure that your antivirus is updated and automatically downloading your virus definitions, running spyware removal programs so that you don't have any nefarious programs on there that are remotely controlling your machine. If you have a wireless connection to the Internet, you have to make sure that your wireless connection is also secured, because an unsecured wireless connection can give anybody within a 300 to 500-foot range of your home or office unfettered access to your data. And then additionally, making sure you have your firewall set up properly and having administrative passwords on your machine. Do you know who's accessing your computer? Is it a friend, a family member, a grandchild? And what are they doing on that computer when they have access to it? Are they downloading rogue programs that might compromise your machine? Are they downloading and installing what's called peer-to-peer file sharing programs that allow free music and movies to be gotten over the Internet, which can also compromise your PC? So there's a lot you need to know to make sure that in the digital age, you're protected.
Now, someone listening to this are going to say, gee, I might become paranoid, worried about what everything my computer can or cannot do to myself. Be short of course, getting your book, The Safety Minute, How to Take Control of Your Personal Security and Prevent Fraud, what can people do, or should people be overly concerned and paranoid about turning on their computers?
Okay, well, here's the thing. First of all, paranoid. I think that you should be aware, you should be alert, and you should take control over your personal security. And just so we are clear on something, and this is important, because when people think about, you know, about their personal security, the first thing they think of is paranoia. And paranoia essentially is a mental illness. It is people who are out of control, overwhelmed, and unable to take care of themselves effectively, Whereas somebody who is security-minded, they are in control, they are alert, they are aware, and they know what their options are. So let's work on changing the society's language as to what security is. So let's be aware, let's be alert, let's be in control, let's be secure instead of paranoid. And once you are secure, then you have control over your information security. You have control over your personal security. And you should be that much more aware and alert, and you should be doing all these different things. And you also need to do two other things, and this is what I want you to do next. You need to invest in identity theft protection, and you need to get yourself a credit freeze. So ultimately, if your data is compromised, whether on your PC or in somebody else's database is hacked somewhere, by investing in identity theft protection, and there's two different things you can do now. Now, I work with Intellius at Intellius.com, and they offer credit monitoring so that anytime anybody tries to open up a new credit card under your name, credit monitoring alerts you to that new inquiry to your credit. You can actually shut that account down before it becomes a problem. Also, Intellius scans the net looking for your information. If your data is out there, they let you know, and they also, you know, turn off all those unwanted credit card offers, and they assist you in the event that your identity is stolen. In addition to identity theft protection, you want to get something called a credit freeze. And a credit freeze is something that you get by touching base with the credit bureaus, and you can lock down your identity in relation to your credit, meaning that the credit bureaus will freeze your credit to prevent anybody from opening up any new accounts under your name. And it's, you know, in addition to all that, you have to make sure that your PC is secured. And if that stuff is overwhelming to you, if it's overwhelming to you to secure your PC, then find yourself a 14-year-old in your life that knows how to do it, because they're usually pretty good at it. So you have to take proactive approaches. You can't sit back and be victimized, because these things can do and will happen to you if you don't put systems in place.
Robert Siciliano is a security consultant to Intellius.com. I thank you very much, Robert, for being on the program with us once again.
I thank you so much. Have a great day.
Robert Siciliano, security consultant for Intellius.com and the author of The Safety Minute, How to Take Control of Your Personal Security and Prevent Fraud. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is 0027, and you can find links to Robert's website plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Coming up in just a matter of moments, Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters, and in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve Arino?
I'm happy, I'm cheerful, I'm filled with joy.
Oh, so many lines, so little time.
I know. I don't know what to say.
You know, I don't have to deal with the CRTC or the FCC anymore, but I still have those sensibilities.
Yeah, I know.
So I'll leave it
sadly,
at that.
When it comes to sensibilities, I've never had them, clearly.
Yes.
Which is life, though, right?
Yes.
Gosh. So, what do you want to talk about this week?
Well, first of all, why are you so happy?
I don't know. I'm just in a good mood, chatting with friends, spending a lot of time with friends. I've had the opportunity to do so, and I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed the life of sloth.
Well, I was about to say, Steve Walsh, international man of leisure.
Yeah, international man of sloth.
Okay. So
there's nothing special about sloth, you know?
But even though you've been doing basically nothing, you still found the time to do the research for this program, which we all appreciate.
Absolutely.
So tell us.
One of my priorities in life, Peter.
Exactly. So tell us, what do you have for us this week?
Okay, let's see. Dateline, Canton, Ohio.
Oh, no, Ohio. I can hardly wait to say goodbye.
Oh, there's that music again. That would
He'd probably be the Buckeye State.
I was going to say that.
Correctly.
I was going to say.
Call it that?
I was going to call it the Buckeye State.
And I used to live there, you know.
I remember.
Many years ago.
Yes.
Well, in Canton, which is a Chinese city in Ohio, a 20-year-old man who police say put a tattoo on the rear end of a one-year-old girl is facing a felony child endangering charge. Lee M. Dietrich. Well, I got to tell you, this person's accused of applying the tattoo in early November while the child was visiting his home. The tattoo is the letter A. It couldn't be removed, that according to a complaint filed with the police department and with the Canton Municipal Court. Now, it wasn't clear why the child was given a tattoo or what the A stands for. See, was it the scarlet letter or something? I don't know.
Yes,
anyway,
yes.
I think it was, yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, this woman identifying herself as Dietrich's grandmother, with whom he lives, or kind of lives with his grandmother, there you go, recalls the infant's 16-year-old aunt being the one who was with the girl when the tattoo was applied. The endangering charge is a third-degree felony. If convicted, he could face up to 5 years in prison. There
wow.
you go, huh?
Now, I'm just looking forward 20 years down the road. You know, this kid's now 21 years old, and she's with her boyfriend, romantic entanglement, whatever the case may be. And he suddenly turns to her and says, I can't help but notice that on your backside you have the letter A tattooed. That used to be tattooed for adultery. When did you get that tattoo? When I was one.
Yeah, I think if we're at the point where he's going to see the letter A, he's not going to worry about what she's got it for.
Well, no, he might. He might.
Yes, he could. That's right. He could be a one-girl guy.
Exactly. Exactly.
She could be
whatever.
Boy, would that like? I'm not even going to make this joke. I'm not, because it might be dirty.
Let's just move along.
Let's just move on. Dateline, Baraboo, Wisconsin.
Ah, that'd be the Badger State.
Or as we like to call it,
the Cheese State.
Where the motto is,
if it's cheddar,
it's better. A Baraboo man was accused of repeatedly shocking this male dance instructor with a stun gun, Peter, claiming that the instructor was, guess what he thought this guy was, and that's why he used the stun gun. He thought the guy was a sinner,
oh.
A sinner who defiles married women. I mean, who amongst us has not? Anyway, a Dane County prosecutor said the suspect, who's 59 years of age, hastily arranged a dance lesson at the instructor's Madison home and showed up with a stun gun and a sledgehammer. The criminal complaint said the man told a detective that his church does not condone touching while dancing and that he was going to scare the instructor and tell him to leave the women alone. The Wisconsin State Journal said the instructor told police that the suspect phoned for private dance lessons, and when he opened the door to his home, he began to shock him repeatedly in the neck with the stun gun.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, stunning, stunning. I couldn't put up with that. It's awful, okay? It's just awful.
It's awful, yes.
I'm so happy with that last story, I think we're going to stay in that state and say, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
Where?
Viroqua.
Okay.
That's just down the road from, no, I don't know where it's down the road from. I think it's up there, up where the Moose and the Badgers play.
Okay. Well, it is the Badger State.
Or and we still call it what?
The Cheese State.
Where the motto is what?
Yeah. If it's cheddar, it's better. Let's get on.
Okay. It's better. Fine. A seven-point buck. By the way, a seven-point buck is a male deer with 7 points on his antlers.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, this buck was found dead in Viroqua back in November, apparently after losing a headbutting contest with a cement statue buck. Now, ramming contests are common during mating season, or as we like to call it here in this part of the country, the rut, and the cement buck was about the same size as the dead buck, but weighs about 3 times as much. So, clearly, you know, guy hoped to have his way and win. I hope she was worth it. That's all I can say. Let's move on. Dateline, Lexington, Kentucky.
That would be the Bluegrass State.
Yeah, I haven't lived there.
Not yet.
Gotcha. In Lexington, a man managed to hit a guardrail and flip his truck while racing down Interstate 64. What makes it dumb is that all this happened because the guy was sniffing an aerosol can. That's known as huffing in this part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
while he was driving. But what makes it unbelievably stupid is that he got the idea from watching an episode of the TV show Intervention and told police he wanted to try it himself.
Wow.
He suffered only minor injuries, and thankfully his female passenger was not hurt. Wow.
You know, that's the kind of story that usually makes it to the idiot of the day, which comes up right after you, I may add.
Good. I'm looking forward to that. But when I listen to this, I love it. I love it, Peter. What can I tell you?
And nowadays you have the time to listen.
Yeah, that's now I have the time.
Yes, you do.
Let's move on. Dateline, Moorhead County, Kentucky.
Careful. It's still the bluegrass state.
Yes. Moorhead County.
Yes.
Back in December, two men, ages 44 and 18, were charged with theft for allegedly swiping an 18-inch long bearded dragon lizard from the Eagles Landing Pet Hospital and trying in two beverage stores to exchange it for liquor.
Wow.
Here's the thing. If they had managed to get the liquor for it,
yes,
there'd be less liquor in the store. Might have drained it, as it were.
Yeah.
Could it be, dare I say it, draining the lizard?
Oh, that's a long way to go, Steve.
I'm sorry. You're not upset, are you?
No, I don't get upset, as you know.
Good. Okay, that's good, because I'm not upset either. But if I did, unlike some people, what I would do is, of course, take, you know, what would I do? I would take keyboard in hand, and I would write a two-minute tirade.
Yes.
Which, by the way, even though I'm not upset, I have done so.
Okay.
Shall I tirade away?
Tirade away.
Thank you. This time, Peter, I want to take on stupid names and stupid spellings of names. By now, many of us are familiar with the sad saga of former Democratic Party presidential candidate John Edwards and his affair with a former staffer. That's a former staffer named Riel, or is it Riley Hunter? It was an affair that led to the birth of a child that scalawag John Edwards had originally claimed was not his, but now insists is his offspring. So much for the sordid dealings of this low-life trial attorney miscreant and his lies. The focus of this rant is his mistress, the mother of the child, and her odd name. If you've watched the news shows and listened to radio reports regarding this story, you might come away wondering, what's the proper pronunciation of this woman's name? On some reports, you hear it Riel Hunter. On others, it's Riley Hunter. The name is spelled R-I-E-L-L-E. What kind of a name is that? What parent in his or her right mind would saddle a child with a stupid name like that? Jokes are made about the strange names given many black children in the United States, names that appear to have been taken from drug vials seen at a pharmacy. We can even think back to National Basketball Association star Anfernee Hardaway and how a former NBA colleague once suggested Hardaway's mother ought to be flat silly for giving her kid such a stupid name. But Riel, or is it Riley Hunter? Gotta tell you, she's as white as can be. It's time to put an end to stupid names that leave people with normal names guessing how those strange names are pronounced. Civility demands no less. By the way, how do they get Brett Favre out of Brett Favre? Just asking.
Because you're a former Canadian or current Canadian dual citizen now living in the United States. That's why you're asking. Ask an American, they'll tell you, well, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
I guess.
Okay. Is that Stephen?
Okay.
Is that Stephen with a V or a PH?
Oh, it's a V. We don't use the PH thing. That would be stupid.
Okay. Sir, say those three magic words.
Hit the V!
This is the Stuff File.
And alas, we are near the end of our dusty trail, the end of the program we like to call the Stuff File. But as you know, if you listen to it on a regular basis, there is still at least one item to go, and that item would be the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
When Stephen Allen Locasio, age 48, checked his alleged marijuana growing operation in Marathon, Florida, the plants were gone. In their place was a note reading, "Thanks for the grow. You want them back? Call for the price. We'll talk." Locasio called, and when he showed up with the negotiated ransom, which was $200, he was arrested. The note was left by detectives from the Monroe County Sheriff's Office who didn't know who had planted the crop. And the real bummer in all of this? Dude, the ransom was booked as evidence, so you can't even use it as bail. Why would someone who is 48 years old and should definitely know better, at least some common sense be involved here, why would someone call the number from an anonymous person to get his ransomed marijuana back and not think that maybe it's a sting operation because it's the cops who are doing this? Well, there's one reason and one reason only. Stephen Allen Locasio, you are an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0027. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And as you know, boys and girls, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's S-T-U-P-H, thestufffile.com. And you'll find information and links on all of our guests there at the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding number of the program. And again, that number is 0027. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder and Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. We hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com and World FM 88.5 FM in New Zealand. Bye-bye.
Getting Jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.